Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action, All the Time, as we continue our journey through the 90s back catalogue of Sylvester Stallone. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's edition, we are talking about Demolition Man. As always, alongside me to dissect the Stallone epic is my regular partner in crime. Yes, it is podcaster, screenwriter, and maniacal supervillain. It's Mr. Craig Draheim.
One of my crimes is murder, death, kill, Scott.
I know it to be true. But that is not all, as we have a very special guest, too. It is ace YouTube movie reviewer and a man we just got out of cryogenic deep freeze to stop Craig's latest dastardly plan. It's me, Mr. Caleb Knutson.
Hey, somebody put me back in the fridge. Let's do this.
Good times. Now, as always, before we dive into this one, I shall give a little bit of background on the movie. So Demolition Man was released on October 8th, 1993, and was kind of weirdly directed by conceptual video artist Marco Brambilla. I think that's how you pronounce his name, in what was his debut feature. It was written by Peter M. Lenkoff, who doesn't have like loads of notable movie credits, but is more of a TV writer and was the creator and showrunner of all those kind of 80s reboot shows. So the kind of, the MacGyver remake and the Magnum P.I. remake and the Hawaii Five-O remake. I realize that Hawaii Five-O is older than the 80s. And then he was eventually fired by CBS because of creating a toxic work environment. So fuck that guy. Anyway, also written by Robert Renault, who doesn't have a whole lot of credits, only four credits. One of them is Action Jackson, which stars Carl Weathers. And finally, it was written by Daniel Waters, whose other notable credits include Heathers and Batman Return. Review-wise, the film is currently sitting at a 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb, our highest rating that we've had so far. Amazing. 60% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 42 reviews. 34 on Metacritic based on only 9 reviews, though, and a 3.2 on Letterboxd. Box office-wise, it made $159.1 million off of a, according to IMDb, $57 million budget, although those estimates rise up to $77 million on Wikipedia, so I'm not sure what's quite correct. So not quite the monster hit that I thought it was for Stallone, but at the time it was still seen as a success and a general sign that Stallone's career was trending upwards again after his slump in the late 80s, early 90s. So, guys, Demolition Man. Craig, like me, you saw this as a kid, right?
Yeah, so I watched it a couple of times as a kid. It's one of those ones that oddly I think I return to every 5 years or so, just randomly, because it's either on TV or like, oh, I'll watch Demolition Man again, mainly for Wesley Snipes, but we'll get into that more. But yeah, this is the first time I've watched it, especially being, you know, living in the United States. And post, you know, Trump being elected and the whole Trump administration stuff. So it was interesting to kind of see some of what is supposed to be satire in there and how it connects with today's society living in the States. It was definitely a different watch than I remember.
True. I mean, like, there's a lot of relevance in it as well in terms of COVID pandemic wise as well, which I think has been noted by a number of people on the internet, the number of articles that have come out about the relevance of Demolition Man, and kind of very much pouncing on that kind of trending of Demolition Man once again, made all these connections with the pandemic and stuff. Stallone did announce in May of last year that he was working on a Demolition Man 2. Caleb, though, you did not watch this as a child.
I was the last couple of years, I've realized that I've had a very sheltered childhood. I didn't watch a lot of these action films from the 90s with all these big stars. If any of them, it was Schwarzenegger, but with his comedies like Kindergarten Cop and things like that. But only really just in my adult life, I've gone back to watch these. This is my second time watching Demolition Man. The first was last year during the whole shutdown and pandemic, trying to watch as many movies as I can. And then someone recommended it for my channel. So watched it, and I remember enjoying it for what it was, being just reminding myself, oh yes, the overalls, how clean everything looks from the 90s. It was a really fun time. Now, last year, kind of going off with Craig was saying, this is the first time watching it since the post-Trump administration. This is also, you know, I watched it during the whole kind of uprising of Black Lives Matter marches and movements, and here we have a white cop going after a black criminal. It was kind of, it was a little jarring in that aspect, but then I guess we realize that this Simon Phoenix, he's one evil MF.
Supposedly. Yes, I mean, like, it's weird because I loved this movie as a kid. I watched it a lot. I've not watched it in a long time. I've probably not watched it since my early 20s, so probably a good 15 years, I would say. And yeah, I probably didn't realize at the time the kind of any talk of, like, it, you know, satirizing political correctness or whatever. But, you know, like, yeah, watching the movie now, I can definitely see why this is like the alt-right's favorite action movie. Because you can definitely read it that way, as a kind of clarion call for the red-blooded, white, heterosexual male, and against any sort of nanny state, and against any sort of cancel culture or quashing of free speech, or, like, you know, because the movie it does in that kind of weird way that the alt-right also do, conflates the issue of like free speech being infringed with people being called out for having asshole opinions. But that's a whole other matter.
Well, there's even the whole section, you know, we'll get to it, where he meets the rookie when he was serving, who is now an old man.
Yeah.
And they're shooting the shit, and he's, you know, insulting them, but because they're friends. And there's even the comment made about, you know, they appear to be friends, but they're insulting each other. And what Sandra Bullock says, something along the lines of, well, this is how, she doesn't say toxic, but something about men with
heterosexual. This is how heterosexual white males communicated. Because they couldn't emote, you know, kind of thing. So it's like, this is why I can't kind of take against the movie too much on those terms, because the politics of the movie is very confused, and it is taking the piss out of kind of action movie archetypes and masculine archetypes as much as it's kind of promoting them at the same time. It's very confused, and then the ending feels kind of tacked on, but we'll discuss that obviously when we get to the end of the movie. It ends up kind of chaotic in its overall philosophy and politics. But I suppose we should, there's plenty to talk about with this movie. So we'll dive into it. Since you're our special guest, Caleb, you can kick us off with how the movie starts.
The year is 1996, and Los Angeles is just one big dumpster fire of Americana, and there is one cop that just demolishes everything wherever he goes to take down whatever criminal he's going after, and that is John Spartan, played by Sylvester Stallone. And here at the beginning, and maybe someone can fill me in on this, but gosh, it feels like there is a lot of stuff that was cut out somewhere in here, but we just jump right into it. He is going to this abandoned building supposedly, where the crime lord, murderer, serial killer guy, whatever exactly he is, Simon Phoenix is, and he needs to capture him because he needs to.
I don't know. Like, the movie can't quite decide. Like, he seems to be like, he's equally presented as if he is a lone maniac killer and as if he is some sort of kind of drug kingpin overlord.
Yeah.
Like, it, yeah, the movie can't quite decide. It's never fully established.
You never see him being evil or doing any of that. Yeah. He's just there. And we, the audience, are just told, yep, he's bad. Okay. Yeah.
He's basically like a comic book villain, or, you know, where it's just, he does, because they show his rap sheet, I think, at one point later on, where it's like, oh, he's just done everything. That's the type of villain he is. He's just...
Oh, yeah. Because, like, yes, when it cuts to the future and, it, like, there's the roll call of his rap sheet, it's, like, just everything. Drug possession, rape, murder, you know, like, just, yeah, the thievery, yeah, just everything. Yeah, that's true.
They want us to know he's just an all-around bad guy.
All-around bad guy who blows up this building that Spartan, they get into a tussle, and Spartan gets Simon out of the building. Supposedly he has hostages, but then he's like, no, I don't. But then they get out of the building, and Spartan is being drilled by his superior officer. Gosh, you destroy everything that you come in contact with. And then out of nowhere, this other guy comes around the corner and says, Chief, there was like 20 or 30 bodies in there.
Oh no, that's all the hostages. Apparently that means that...
Apparently that we never see.
Yeah. But he did a thermal scan beforehand, and it didn't say there was all those hostages.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
But for some reason, the chief takes the word of a well-known criminal over the... I don't know.
Because Simon is saying, yeah, like, yep, he knew that they were there the whole time, but he didn't care because he wanted to come after me.
Yeah,
which he says in hilarious stuff. There was a couple of things I wanted to mention about this scene as well. One, that it looks very much like Escape from New York. We discussed that kind of just before we started this. And, like, yeah, I double-checked that Escape from New York was set in 1997. So it's very close. And then, yes, the far-off year of 1996, when this was made in 93. Yeah, and it's weird. It's weird. It looks like the helicopter or something's firing off lasers in the opening scene. And I thought it was very funny, and I think this goes to the fact that Stallone is the only one who thinks he's in a serious sci-fi action picture. Is like the start where he jumps out of the plane and he just growls, Phoenix! I was like, why? Well, yes. That's a character choice. I don't know what you're doing there.
Are we supposed to believe, like, these are like two just like long time foils of each other? Like,
yeah, we're just supposed to kind of dive into that and believe that they have this kind of long standing history, and he's been hunting them down for years or whatever. Yeah, I think we're just, I like, apparently this in the original script, this scene didn't exist. There, it was inserted in a rewrite that Fred Decker did. He did an uncredited rewrite. Yeah, so he and he inserted this prologue.
So the original script opening was just them coming out of cryogenic.
Presumably, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So, like, Fred Decker's quote that, you know, if you don't see Kansas, Oz isn't so special. I thought that was quite a fun line. Obviously it went through various rewrites because the original script was done by Lenkoff, and he wrote up a kind of straight up inspired by Lethal Weapon kind of action movie. And then, like, the satire and the comedy and all that was really added by Daniel Waters, who, you know, obviously has a good hand at comedy. He wrote Heathers. And, like, you can tell as well that the year before he had written Batman Returns, and that's why maybe, like, Simon Phoenix has that kind of comic book quality to him. Okay. And Like the other thing I wanted to mention about Simon Phoenix is just the fashion. Just what he this get up he's wearing. I definitely think this needs to be mentioned. I mean, like, I don't know if either of you guys are wrestling fans, but so there was a team that a kind of short lived team, which I think was called High Energy, that like was Owen Hart and Coco Beware, and the jacket he's wearing is very similar to, like, you can look that up. It's very similar, and he's wearing, like, as well as that, as well as this very early 90s Czech jacket, he is wearing, like, basically MC Hammer parachute pants as well. It's amazing as a get up.
Never thought in a million years I would be on a podcast where someone mentions Coco
Beware. I drop random wrestling references into all my podcasts.
Man, wow. You mentioned Batman Returns. A little fun fact I realized when I'm listening to the music, the score of this opening sequence, I'm like, I have heard this this melody line before. I've heard this type of music before, and I was getting Batman vibes from it. Come to find out that the composer, Elliot Goldenthal, I think is how you pronounce it, he scored the movies. Me being a huge Batman fan, he scored the movies Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, those good old little gems from the 90s. Like, yes! He just repurposed his score. He absolutely...
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think, like, particularly later on in the movie, in the sewer battle scene and in the kind of finale, the big face-off at the end, the score gets very Batman-y.
Well, we'll get to all the ice puns that should have been thrown out there.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
Also, in the beginning, there's a lot of foreshadowing because Phoenix puts gasoline on the floor, and then he talks about being so forgetful he would lose his head, and that pops up, a little liquid on the floor, and losing of head in the end. Wink,
wink. Yes, heavy foreshadowing.
And it opens with fire, and it ends with him being covered in ice. How poetic is that?
Yeah.
Well, this film is layered.
That's so many goddamn layers.
The beginning is the first 6 minutes.
I know. What I'll give this movie, especially watching it this time, before we go on further, is thinking about, I guess, you know, writing my notes down and everything about what we're going to talk about for this. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, there's a, even though it's kind of this straight action film or whatever it may be, there's a lot of little nuanced elements that'll give it that of world building.
That
give it credit for.
It gives itself way more time than a lot of action movies. And like, I like the world building stuff. Like, you know, after this initial six minutes, I like, you know, like there's like 20 minutes where Stallone's not on the screen.
Yeah.
Right. At all. And it's just all kind of, it's kind of world building, and we kind of mainly follow the Sandra Bullock character. Although, before we get to that, we should mention that John Spartan, which is, again, you know, this is clearly, 1993, clearly the year of the action movie parody, because obviously Last Action Hero came out this year as well. It's just kind of taking the mic out of kind of action movies, because John Spartan is clearly the most on the nose kind of action man name that you can kind of come up with. And obviously, again, you know, this movie has no idea of subtlety, you know, again, like calling its main villain Simon Phoenix, and he will of course rise again. But Spartan is cryogenically frozen. And it's impressive that this film made, again, in 1993, that thought in 3 years they would perfect cryogenic freezing.
And I, watching it this time, you know, I've seen both movies so many times throughout my life, but I was like, oh, wait, this is the, how did I never connect this and Austin Powers? For some reason in my head, I just never did. And it's just like,
a fair point.
Yeah.
Warm liquid goo phase.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is what I was thinking my first time watching this too. I'm like, this is I know Austin Powers is a parody on like Bond and all like 80s, 90s action, but this is one of the elements that they stole, right? It has to be.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Of course, I didn't like it. It's sort of funny because like I've seen that movie a lot. I like in my childhood saw that movie a lot and saw this movie a lot. And I didn't really kind of, I mean, obviously, yeah, it's the same thing. I didn't really kind of add it up. But yeah, it was a good point. That's a good point. And we also get more kind of, as we kind of discussed on last week's episode, obviously, you know, Stallone just loves showing off his ass. Yeah. It's all about his ass.
He was showing off his ass, and he needs to show off all the horse tranquilizers that he's taken to get muscles in places where people don't even have places.
But
he changes positions, right? Like, he doesn't, when he's frozen, like, that arm is in one spot, and then when we see him again, he's moved.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, is that just not a continuity issue, or maybe he was unfrozen at certain points, but... I'm thinking that this is just a continuity issue.
I think it's just a continuity issue because he wasn't supposed to get a parole hearing until after this movie is set. It was like, you know, because it says in his sentencing, oh, you won't even get parole for like 70 years or whatever, you know. Like,
Was it about the whole hostage thing and them dying to where it pushed the district attorney's office to be like, this guy, this cop, we're freezing him, as opposed to suspending, going through rehabilitation in some way, or like firing from the force? He made a mistake, and they're like, oh, you're being frozen.
And they don't want even check, I don't know, they don't, it's like, it's just a very quick trial. It's we don't even see the trial. And he gets a harsh
sentence. No, we just get sentencing. We just thought it was
he doesn't see his wife that he's so concerned
about. He gets a harsher sentence than the criminal himself. Right.
How did this happen?
I don't know. It's very confusing. It is very, very confusing.
Happened because it needed to. So,
So he's frozen in this new thing, but the whole part of the freezing process too is that they'll basically subliminally inject thoughts into them to make them more docile when they come out.
So kind of reprogram them.
Because he's reprogrammed to be a seamstress, I guess. That's the one of the later on, I guess, that was probably written in later. But yeah, when he's unfrozen, he like knows how to crochet. But Simon Phoenix is getting secret subliminal messages of killing someone or learning how to kill, even though he already knew how to kill.
But right? Learning how to kill more efficiently,
yeah,
more kill skills, train him in martial arts for some reason, you know, and stuff like that.
Was there a reason why we didn't get the freezing sequence for Simon Phoenix? We only watched Stallone get naked and frozen. Did Wesley Snipes not want to do that, or do we know?
Probably time, or they probably just, I don't know, even know. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe just time. I don't know. Or maybe like Stallone was like, no, I'm the only one getting naked here.
Because they're trying to promote that these two people are they're opposing forces. Why not have the dual shots of both of them going through the same horror of being frozen? But I guess, I mean, Scott, I think you're right. Stallone was just like, no, shoot my naked body.
Do you know what you talk about that of like them being two opposing forces, and I do feel like because Snipes as Simon Phoenix kind of cuts all his dialogue like he's cutting wrestling promos, like I always remember the VHS cover for this where it's just them facing off, and it does look like a WrestleMania videotape of like, it's the irresistible force meets the immovable object, you know, like it has definitely wrestling vibes.
Mega powers collide.
Yeah, exactly.
The ultimate challenge. And well, I mean, WWF was huge then. That was Hogan at his ultimate powers. And then you had characters like Savage and, Andre, even though it was really the end of his career.
Yeah, because Andre, I believe, died in 93.
Yeah, I think, yep. I think you're right.
Yeah.
So last time, at least I saw him in wrestling, was WrestleMania 7, and I think he died, and that was 91. Yeah, I think it was a couple of years later. So, yeah. But so far, we've covered the 90s, but it jumps all the way forward to 2032.
Yes.
Yeah. Where we get to
11 years in the future.
Yeah. And so in 11 years, we'll be in a utopian society of...
Well, yeah, rare... like, again, this is not entirely explained of, like, how far this extends. Like, this, it's kind of suggested that this only extends to, like, L.A. County.
Right.
Yeah, so it's L.A., San Diego, and what, there's one more.
Part of California is under this rule, but it doesn't seem like we're all part of it, like, or anything. It doesn't even seem like North America, he's controlling North America. He's just controlling this part of California, it seems.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. That was driving me crazy. Is this the whole world, or is this just America, or is this just California? Because I was getting the same vibe you were getting, Scott, where it was just this little small section of California. Within this time period, did all cops just in surrounding districts forget how to use a gun? Couldn't they have called someone else from, like, Nevada or some surrounding states to come in and take care of him, or...
Yeah, like in terms of like we've credited this film for world building, but in this aspect, this has always confused me. Like, I've watched this movie a bunch of times throughout my childhood and stuff like that, but I've never got any sense from this film that this society is happening anywhere else in the world outside of the kind of mashup LA, San Diego, you know, whatever other places in California. That Cocteau is in charge of and has created this utopian bubble.
Well, they even say that because you think, what was it, the last murder or whatever on record was in there, which,
2011, I think they said.
Yeah.
2010?
Yeah,
2010.
2010, and you'd think there would have to be somebody on the force, like you were saying, Caleb, because it's only been, 22 years since then.
The old guy that's working for the force, when Stallone sees him and he's like, "Hey, you son of a gun."
Yeah.
Like, he would remember how to use a weapon, right?
Yeah. Which I know. So,
yeah, I suppose that's the other kind of confusing element in the movie, that there's like older police officers who react to the violence that happens in the same way as the younger police officers. And you're like, no, you're definitely old enough to remember how violence was. So your reactions to this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And I don't know. I know that with that character, when I was doing my research on it, he was originally, Simon Phoenix was supposed to kill him. And that's why you just don't really see him, but they got rid of the scene. That's why you don't see him anymore. And then, I don't know. Anyways, but that's one of those weird things, because then also with the scraps, the like underground dwellers, you'd think, well, why wouldn't you just move to a different city where you can have these freedoms? Why are you staying in this place where you'd have to live underground then? I don't know.
Because it's a movie, Craig. Yeah. 1993.
Because the script says so.
That's wild.
Yeah, but like, yeah, it does lead to confusion, because unlike, some like kind of other, kind of dystopian things, be it movies or novels, or some of the novels is drawn from, something like A Brave New World or 1984 or Handmaid's Tale, or like movies like Mad Max, you do get a sense like this is the world as it is now, whereas you don't get this sense at all in this.
Yeah, as long as you're putting out the rules and kind of just everything that everyone has to obey by, we're good. But yeah, you're right, it's who's obeying by this?
Yeah.
Because if it's just California, I feel like they could phone another police district from another state saying, "Hey, you guys have guns. Could you come over and take care of this Phoenix guy? We don't need to unfreeze Stallone other than the movie, because he's not the only one." But however, I do enjoy a lot of the peaceful stuff from this society. We have people aren't touching, which I gotta say. Pretty relevant to what's happened in the last
pretty year. Pretty relevant indeed. like, yeah, the kind of high five, that the mid-air high five that they do, and the kind of hello, wind wiper hello.
Driving cars, they got that one right.
Yeah, that's right.
So when we first jump, it's not to Simon, it's to Sandra Bullock's character, doing her routine check-ins with the prison.
Who is called, we should point out, yeah, Lenina Huxley. And Lenina is the first name of a character in a central character in Brave New World. And Huxley is obviously the surname of its writer, Aldous Huxley. The movie's not subtle, but it's
yeah, you know,
it puts them in there.
And then she is kind of, she's not a rookie, but she's just one who, she just wishes there was something more, but nobody else, you know, everybody else is just happy living in utopia, basically. And she wants some action.
Even though she doesn't really know what action is, she just,
yeah,
she wants it, other than from Lethal Weapon 3 and Jackie Chan movies, as we find out with all of her trinkets.
Yeah, that's right. I do love when we go into her office, and like, obviously it's just because it's another Joel Silver produced picture, but she's got like a big poster of Lethal Weapon 3 on the wall, and she's got like a Red Hot Chili Peppers poster, and it's a very, very excellently 90s office.
And a Warner Brothers office too, because there was the 89 Joker and Batman figurines I saw in the corner. Yeah.
Yes.
She had to spend
very much made by Warner Brothers trying to like push their products.
She had to spend a lot of credits to get all that stuff, as she'll say later on. And when we see her apartment.
Yep.
Yeah.
But she seems to be kind of like the go-to officer when Phoenix is unfrozen for his parole, because that seems like a lot of work just to unfreeze someone for their parole hearing. Refreeze them again, but it's what happens. And he's gotten the message in his brain of what the password is to unleash himself and takes over. But she's the one that kind of takes control of everyone. Everyone's like, what's this code? I've never understood what this code is. What, code 187 or something like that?
Yeah.
Is murder, death, kill?
Yeah.
What? I would feel bad if my police officers didn't know what codes were in their book. I'll just put that out there.
So,
even if you haven't seen one.
Yeah. Oh, what? One thing, you know, obviously the logic thing that will hurt me throughout this. Why would you have your, like, I guess your handcuffs and all that be able to all open up with the word teddy bear or any sort of word at all? It seems crazy, but no, this is when I think.
Oh, that's you're definitely, I mean,
yeah,
you shouldn't do this with any action movie. Bearing that sort of logic. I mean, like, there's kind of logic points that we can, like, our discussion about the kind of world building and how it's slightly askew, that like, is this just happening in California, whatever. I mean, logic like that, fair enough, but logic like that you're discussing now, you can't sit through action movies bearing that sort of logic on it.
Yeah.
It's just a world of madness you're entering into.
So, but this is where I think you know, you get a sense of him, but he seems more like a comic evil villain when we first meet him back in the 90s. But Simon Phoenix, like, I think this is where he really shines, when he doesn't know why he has the information he has, and the comedy of Wesley Snipes really starts coming through. And we talked about this before recording, but, and you know, we'll get through it to it throughout, you know, this episode more. But I mean, for being such a horrible guy, he is delight to just watch on screen.
Oh, he is.
Oh, he's so fun.
Most fun out of this entire movie.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think when he first unleashes himself from the handcuffs, and he's like just kicking those guys' asses, and he's like, and they, like, one of his lines that he quips is like, Simon says die, and it's just the way the relish when he says it is so much
fun. Yeah, and it even goes to, yeah, he's just surprised at how good he is too, and that's what I love about it.
Were those one-liners, were they written down, or
I don't know, like, I think like the director said that like Wesley Snipes did improvise some shit. So, like, could be one of his kind of improvised lines.
Yeah.
And also, like, one of the scenes that always sticks out in my mind is like, I think partly because like I really don't like things to do with eyes or eye violence. Oh. So yeah, very much as a kid, when he takes out the pen and I don't know, like when I was a kid, like I think I kind of, you know, I would continually slightly misremember this movie and think that he dug the pen into his eye and then he took it out and then he scanned it, but it's not cut like that at all. I'm just imagining I'm seeing more than I was, yeah, always really kind of stuck out in my mind as a kind of
Winston-juicing. You leave the eyes and leave the throat alone. I think that's where sheltered childhood comes from. Was anyone else, I don't know if we have any Always Sunny in Philadelphia fans here, but the password to unlock the handcuffs is Dayman. Did anyone sing the Dayman song from Philadelphia when you...
It's not a show I've actually seen. It's one that people are recommend it to me. People are like, oh man, like this show is, you know, it's got your kind of sense of humor, you really like it. And but now I'm just at the stage of there's so much things to watch, and when I discovered there's like 12, 13 whatever seasons of it, I was like, ah, there's no way I can catch up on this. I just can't.
Best watch if you want to. I actually started watching it last month and I'm already to season 8. It just kind of flies by.
Okay.
But one of them, they do a musical, and it's a terrible musical, but it's called The Nightman Cometh, about the Dayman fighting the Nightman. It's god-awful, but there's a really fun song. It's Dayman. Ah. I'm alone here, though, so I'm going to stop talking.
I didn't see the music. I know the... when they, because there's the episode when they're getting high doing it or something, but I don't think I saw the musical one of it. It's just the...
Oh, yeah, that's right, because they got the initial idea when they were sniffing paint or whatever.
Yeah, one of the, and like, see, why I won the season.
The show's great!
Okay. maybe I will come around to checking it out. There's just so much things to watch,
yeah,
including this. But we'll get back to what's happening in the movie, because we're really not that far into the movie. No. So
so right now it's basically the cops are watching through monitors that Simon Phoenix, he took one of the doctor's cars, and now he just kind of pulled over and they're all excited. They're like, oh, well, we found where he's at. He's on Wilshire in Santa Monica, and we'll send all of our units. And then, you know, Simon Phoenix gets out. And this is another kind of delightful scene where he's on the computer. He's and he's hacking, but he's so impressed with himself because, you know, he could never do that. But I like beforehand the guy that's talking to the computer and needing to be consoled, or the computer's trying to help him with his depression.
Yeah, and he just kind of shoves him out of the phone booth that has these computers that can console you and connect to bank accounts and stuff, and tell you all sorts of things, apparently.
Which, again, is something that we have now. There are apps out there that, you know, help you fall asleep and
right.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, this another thing that this film got.
This movie predicted a lot. Yeah, for sure.
But then the cops show up and they, again, just don't know how to deal with criminals. And they're talking to their little computer device that's teaching them or telling them what to do. And one of the things is they say, proceed with extreme assertiveness, which I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But yeah.
No idea. But it's funny.
Trying to take them down and doesn't go well for them.
Yeah. And so that's what is, I think, adds to some of the humor, is that the dialogue in itself even changes. So the way they'll interact with one, they normally call each other by their full names, I noticed. And there's all these kind of random words that are thrown in that just feel like, you know, from a screenwriting perspective, you know, somebody went through the thesaurus and it's like, yeah, let's just use a bigger word or something that to make it sound more like official or more, I guess, peaceful in a way. They're all trying to, you know, you could see where as we were talking about before, where the right would attach to the cancel culture element of it or right. Like that, because everything's very PC and not wanting to step on anybody's toes, and you know.
Yeah, for sure. You can definitely see why the kind of Fox News crowd kind of latched on to this
this movie. The other thing I kind of noted about this scene, and I think it's just because it's one of those things where it's like, it's the 90s and, you know, like, we gotta do certain things, is like, so Wesley Snipes is like kicking these police officers' asses. He's using all these cool martial art moves. He's throwing high kicks. He's punching guys out. He's doing all the sort of things. And while he's beating these guys up, there's these like hip hop beats that play throughout. And like, and you can tell that it's not somebody who's like, it's not made, the movie's not made by somebody who's particularly a lover of hip hop or whatever, because it's like that really kind of cheesy early 90s kind of MC Hammer Vanilla Ice style hip hop beats that are played over him kicking these people's ass. And like, it comes up again, like these kind of cheesy hip hop beats that sometimes just pop up kind of wacky.
Yeah, but we also can't forget, you know, as I talked about prior, is that the glorious overalls that he's wearing.
Oh, yeah. More great fashion choices.
Yeah.
I don't think he takes off. I think he, that's his...
That's his get-up. Like, those, like, dungarees with his, like, kind of orange top. That he's got. Yeah, that's his get-up.
Yeah.
Denim dungarees.
Yeah.
So, apparently, according to various internet sources, not just like Wikipedia, but various internet sources, the haircut, his bleach blonde haircut, inspired Dennis Rodman.
Oh, really?
To his hair. Yeah. Fun fact.
I mean, it's glorious, all of it.
There are a lot of hairstyles in this movie that were glorious in their own right, that are kind of making a comeback now with a little patch of color in the head or whatever. And
oh yeah, I mean, like the best ones are Simon Phoenix's haircut and Associate Bob's haircut. That's a choice.
Yeah,
but we'll get to Associate Bob. Later on.
So I guess, so he lays waste to the cops that are there, and then he just kind of goes off again. And this is where we get the, where we're kind of getting the exposition on Simon Phoenix, right? Where the cops are figuring out who he really is.
Yeah. And we get the big long rap sheet that we talked about. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the older cop who has been chaired, I guess as he considers it, knows the answer. But I don't think, or do they officially want to wake him up, want to wake up Spartan yet? That's why I can't remember, or if there was a scenes within it with like the CEO, or because there's a couple jumps back.
Yeah, I know. Like, so before we get into like Spartan being woken up, or the idea of Spartan being woken up, we get a brief introduction of our villain or other villain. Raymond Cocteau, who is the creator of this society, and played by British actor Nigel Hawthorne, who apparently hated being in this movie, didn't enjoy his time on it at all, and only took the role because he had previously missed out on a role in a movie called Shadowlands to Anthony Hopkins, and he really wanted to get the role for The Madness of King George, but thought that he would have to make himself a bigger name so he did not miss out on the role in The Madness of King George, which he got. But it turns out the joke was on him, because he didn't need to take this role, because the playwright, Alan Bennett, who wrote The Madness of King George for the stage, had actually demanded that both him and the director, Nicholas Hintner, be attached to the project. So if he had just passed that along to Hawthorne himself, Hawthorne would have saved himself being in this movie, which apparently he really didn't enjoy, and apparently Stallone and Snipes, as a matter of course, just turned up super late on set, and it just annoyed him, and I think he thought the whole film was hokum. So so there we go. That was the experience of British thespian Nigel Hawthorne.
I'm sure he got a decent paycheck, maybe.
Probably, I presume. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he did all right out of it. And then he got his dream role in Madness King George, and I can't remember if he won the Oscar, if he was just nominated, but like, anyway, like, it all worked out for him, you know. Or as it was released in the, oh no, I think it was Yeah. No, it was released in the States as The Madness of King George. It originally was going to be released as Madness of King George III. Apparently, US marketers thought that US audiences would be confused that there was not a first and second part to this. I don't know if this is legend or if it's true.
That sounds
anyway.
Right. Yeah.
That sounds about right for American audiences.
I don't want to come across as the anti-American, Scottish guy. You know, like.
I'll say it. I'm American. Yeah, we're done.
Sure. Yeah, you can say it, and then it's kind of fine. Then it doesn't seem like one of those fucking snide Europeans like talking shit about us again. Yeah.
Well, that just proves that actors will do anything for my master's have been through performance and acting, so I'm not saying it from someone who doesn't know the culture and everything.
Yeah.
I know about it. Actors will do anything for a role.
Yeah, that's true. Droids. But I do, I mean, like, it's, I suppose the difference, I always feel the difference is, like, if you're unashamed about it, I'm cool with it. If you're trying to hide it, it seems, like, weird to me. Like, I remember an interview with Michael Caine, where somebody was asking him about Jaws 4, The Revenge, and how that is generally considered as one of the worst movies ever made. And Michael Caine very honestly answered and said, "I've never seen the movie, but I've seen the house it bought." Fair enough.
Enjoys the
you
house.
Win.
Well, because he also won the Oscar the year that he was shooting Jaws 4, and they wouldn't let him leave to go accept his award. they kept him there. Because they knew if he would have left, he would have never come back.
Yeah, fair point. He would have been like, "Yeah, well, it's quite a lot of money, but is it really worth it?"
Pretty ridiculous. A roaring shark.
Oh, still much weirdness in that film.
You never want to go down that road. But yeah, we get Nigel Hawthorne, and he's telling the police chief to use creative methods to take down this ruffian.
He gives a brief speech about Edgar Friendly, who we encounter a little while later, and then he has the call with the Chief George Earl, which is played by Bob Gunton, who previously appeared in our Glimmerman episode.
Yep.
Which, how Bob Gunton didn't end up being a villain, I have no
idea. Yeah, I actually, in my head, for some reason, thought that Bob Gunton was the villain. I don't know why.
Well, you just saw his face and you're like, "Oh, Bob Gunton's in this. Oh, he's bound to be one of the villains."
I mean, I don't know. For some reason, I thought, "Oh, yeah, he's the villain." And then I watched the movie. I went, "Wait a minute. No, he's a cop." Did I just manufacture that in my brain that he was the villain? And
it's a bit like, it's a bit like when Kyle and I did the rapid fire episode, where we both misremembered that Powers Booth was a villain, one of the villains of the movie. He's not. He was a good guy. He was Brandon Lee's ally in the movie. But we just saw Powers Booth and he was like, "Well, of course he's a bad..." Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I for the first time, watched Southern Comfort this year. So in 2021, I have seen two films in which Powers Booth, good guy.
There you go.
Anyway, we're really not that far into this movie. We can't afford any more to it. Our tangent credits are up.
Yeah.
All right.
So he has a Zoom call, basically, with his...
More
his
great comp- predictions yeah. from Demolition Man.
Yeah. With his people, talks about Friendly, who is this... All we know from right now is that he's basically an anarchist. That's what they assume, and that he's destroying everything. And it's not actually... And he's the cause of, you know, leading to things like Simon Phoenix and all that. And then, yeah, so he tells the chief to use any method necessary, get creative. And then is that when we kind of go into, they're talking with the old police officer I forgot to write down his name, who tells them, well, back
Zach
in...
Zach Lamb. Zachary Lamb, played by Bill Cobb. It's kind of face you'll see in many a movie.
Where he says that, back in the 90s, he was captured by, it's basically an exposition dump for the characters that don't know who John Spartan is.
And I really wanted, this is a great little moment where, like, so Sandra Bullock's character has been doing like independent research on the career of John Spartan. And so we get this video highlight package of John Spartan's career. And he is very much the poster boy for police brutality. Yeah. And like, but the best bit in it, where it does feel like, you know, we are very much in the territory of parodying action movies, is when we get a newsreel where there has been like, he's John Spartan is carrying this little girl in his arms, and he's being asked by this news reporter, like, was it really worth blowing up this $7 million mall for this hostage that had like a 25 grand ransom on her head? And the little girl like turns around to the news reporter and goes, "Fuck you, lady."
Yeah.
And what makes it even better as well is like, and this is why I think it's definitely a kind of action movie spoof about the property damage done in action movies. Because like in that scene as well, it looks like Stallone has like his Rambo mullet as well, which just makes it even more entertaining.
Yeah, and there definitely is throughout it too. They do, not to the same extent as, you know, Last Action Hero or whatever, but they mention Schwarzenegger at several points. They mention Rambo. It's like they throw out all the stops of mentioning other action films.
Yeah, it doesn't get as meta as anywhere near as meta as Last Action Hero. But yeah, there's a good dollop of kind of meta winking at you, at the audience. Yeah.
So they decide they're going to basically unfreeze John Spartan, because he's the only one. You need a maniac to get a maniac, capture a maniac.
Yeah, if somebody else says old-fashioned criminal, we need an old-fashioned cop.
Yeah.
Which, is that a metaphor for Stallone's career at this point? It's like this is like one of the big resurgence. This is the big resurgence year for him. Yeah. But he had that long string of films where he started to kind of die out in the action star went from people like Schwarzenegger and Stallone to kind of everyman type guys like Bruce Willis and Keanu Reeves. But this kind of feels like, no. Remember how cool and great Stallone was? Here he is now. So I feel like that's like the line of the movie for Stallone to feed his ego here.
Yeah.
Yeah. These scrawny men can't take it on. You need muscle.
You need good old roided up brawn. That's what you need.
Yeah. Yeah. Force tranquilizer blood. But then they unfreeze him, and then again, this is where I was talking about in the beginning. Would have been nice to have seen his wife at some point.
Yeah.
Unfreeze him, and the first thing he says, "I got a wife. What happened? What happened to her?" And then they say she's fired. But and then he says, "Oh, I had a daughter."
Yeah.
What happened to her? And then they quickly go away from that talk, which
yeah, they just move right on. Like we established that the wife is dead, but like we established nothing about the daughter. A plot point that we think will be picked up upon later, but not so much.
Yeah.
Which led me to believe that Bullock was the daughter for the entire film until the end, or at least until the sex scene, actually.
Yeah, right. That's kind of the
which I know that's it was a big fan theory for why, because when I was doing the research on finding out more about the daughter, that was one of the main questions that popped up. Was she was Huxley his daughter through it? So it gets a common, I guess, thing. And then the daughter again was supposed to be in it, and then I think the chief kind of stops things and says, "You have a mission to do."
Right.
But because the daughter was associated with the scraps, or I don't know, there was supposed to be like some sort of element of why, you know, the information of the daughter wasn't being given to him.
Because then if he would have heard that she was in part of the scraps, he would have gone to her instead of the mission.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, this is all makes sense.
From what I pieced together, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, like, so the original cut of the movie, there was an entire subplot where he discovers his daughter and she is part of the scraps and stuff like that. But that was scrapped because Warner Brothers wanted a shorter runtime, even though at an hour and 55 minutes, it's relatively long for an action movie of this time.
Yeah.
Well, Warner Brothers has a history of cutting things a lot from very famous superhero movies recently. Yeah, but so he is unfrozen. They say, hey, you got a mission. And then he starts learning about all the fun new rules of this utopia where everything that is bad for you is illegal. Caffeine's illegal. Smoking's illegal. Women getting pregnant, I guess, is illegal.
Unless you have a license.
Unless you have a license, right? Which, again, they got it right. The government putting, you know, laws on women's bodies—they're what America loves to do.
And then if you swear, you get credit, like a little paper.
You
will
get
come
like
out.
A fine, basically.
Yeah, it'll be a fine. Yeah. And that's
and you also you use the bathroom with shells.
Yeah, there's three seashells that we never find out. That's kind of the ongoing joke, but everybody knows except him, and they kind of make Rob Schneider, who's a random cop in it, he makes a little joke about him not knowing what the three seashells do. But then we get Stallone, and one of the few, but he doesn't even sell it well, I guess, for the comedy sake. He goes up to the machine that spits out the fines and starts swearing a bunch to get more paper, which is so he can have toilet paper to finally, you know, since he's been frozen.
Yeah.
He needs to take a dump.
which I was wondering, because he went to the bathroom and then he comes out like, hey, you're out of toilet paper. You got these shell things. And I'm wondering, like, did you take a shit?
And then just not wipe.
Or did you hold it and you're waiting for something?
I thought about that too, because it makes it sound like he already went.
Yeah, no, it definitely does.
So he was just walking around without having wiped.
But hey, that's how we did it in 96.
Yeah.
Taking down these criminals, we don't care. All the shit covered trousers we have. On the bad guys. Snipes is going for a gun now.
Yeah.
Because like, so the computer says that he's going to start a drug den, apparently. But Stallone knows better. John Spartan knows better. He's going to go after a gun. And then, you know, Chief Bob Gunton is all like, well, the only place you can get a gun is in the museum. And so obviously we then cut immediately to the museum where Snipes is being randomly racist for some reason before getting some guns.
Which for some reason in a museum, they left like the firing pins and all that stuff and just bullets for all of these guns.
Yeah, because all museums do that. They have live ammunition with all the, you know, all the museums that I've been to you know, keep the cannonballs with the cannons and you know, with you know, the gunpowder and all that, you know, all the stuff for all the old weapons, you know, that you see as artifacts. Yeah, definitely all that. That definitely is how museums work. I love how the exhibit that he goes to see is called the Hall of Violence.
Yeah. And so he is trying to break through the glass he can. And that's when you kind of get the politeness, I guess, of these people where they come up. And even though he's kicking it and he's, you know, I guess, causing a disturbance, he asks the guy, how much does he weigh? And then throws him through the glass and starts grabbing the guns. And he's like, oh, yeah, this is the future. So there better be those laser guns. He finds one, but it's going to take 2 minutes to warm up or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The computer gives him a very precise time of 2 minutes and something seconds before it can shoot.
And again, this is just, you know, wonderful moments of seeing Wesley Snipes' charisma and just being, you know, chewing the scenery, as we'll keep saying. And that's really why you're watching it. Like,
it is great. It is definitely why you're watching it.
Well, and that's this is the Rambo line, right?
Yeah.
Where he takes a gun and he says, "Excuse me, Rambo."
Yeah.
And
on his way over, listening to some commercial tunes, like legit commercial tunes in the car ride over, and then he proceeds to do old John Spartan stuff that we got 6 minutes of in the beginning.
Yeah. And that is kind of one of those funny satirical elements, is that their version of oldies are, and it's the most popular station in the area, is all jingles.
Yeah, because I suppose it kind of ties into the whole kind of satire of like, this is like the most blandest, beigest, watered down world, where like, obviously, you know, something as dangerous as rock and roll wouldn't exist, so they just live on like old TV themes and ad jingles, you know.
And I love, because later on at the restaurant, I won't spoil the name of it yet, the piano player is playing the Green Giant jingle, and he's like playing it very
he's crooning. Like
he's crooning. It's basically like, it's like a kind of Richard Cheese number of, you know, the Jolly Green Giant.
And it's wonderful. But anyway, so going back, so all Spartan has is they call it a glow stick, which is basically just like a stun dick thing, baton thing. And he's testing.
Which he randomly uses on just an innocent passerby to see if it works. Yeah. Again, poster boy for police brutality.
Didn't even get a credit for that either.
Yeah. And then he walks in, tells them to wait out there, and which it's, Benjamin Bratt is one of, right?
Isn't he? Yeah, really? Benjamin Bratt.
There we go.
Who plays Officer Alfredo Garcia.
Which is that a throwback to Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, the Sam Peckinpah?
I mean, could be. There's a lot of, like, yeah, because like I keep a, because I think a lot of things, the names seem to be like that. You know, obviously we mentioned the Huxley thing, and like, even like, I did wonder, like, the Cocteau character, if that was a reference to the filmmaker, poet, you know, like, to artist John Cocteau. I don't know. Like, so there does seem to be a few references like that.
Okay.
So it could be a reference to Alfredo Garcia, or it could just be like, you know, Hollywood in the 90s, where it's just like, this is a Latino set.
Yeah. And so now we get, they're finally meeting again, and the only way for them to meet is with violence and bullets. And this is, it's basically, Spartan goes in and they're talking back and forth with one another, and, you know, they both want to kill each other, but, you know, obviously Phoenix is having some fun with it and is, you know, making comments about glad to see him, so now he can kill him himself or whatever it may be, and little quips. And then Spartan is able to get some guns, and so they're going through this whole museum firing guns, and then they go into a basement section of the museum, which has a working hydrant, like a fire hydrant for some reason, with a water pump to it.
Recreation of a gangster street, or I forget how they put it, but like a crime-ridden alley or something like that.
Yeah. So it seems to be like basically like a recreation of what we saw at the start of the film, of like South Central LA 1996, that terrible, terrible year.
During the Great Urban Wars.
Yes.
And so finally, though, when it looks like he electrocutes Phoenix at one point by putting the stick in the water.
And we should mention that Snipes really sells that. It is a really comical, cartoonish electrocution.
Yeah.
I think there was a sound effect of like a boing or something.
Yeah.
As he jumps, and I'm like, that was well done, sir.
Yeah. And he even does that shake off where it's like, and stuff like that. And no, it's great. And that, but finally the tables kind of turn, because this gun that he thought was useless has finally charged. And it's, you know, basically like a laser cannon that he starts blowing up the place, trying to get Spartan.
And then he climbs out, and the Spartan is kind of shooken and getting his bearings. But while Phoenix is climbing out, just randomly, Nigel Hawthorne is there to give exposition.
Because the script says so.
The script says we need to move along. So let's put Nigel Hawthorne just there. And we come to find out that know, Phoenix is going to do the Phoenix thing and just kill everyone in sight, but he can't kill Nigel Hawthorne because he's the one that's been implanting all of the messages while he was frozen into his brain. Having him go kill Mr. Friendly, the leader of all the scraps down in the sewers, can't kill him.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
Sarah freaking evil.
And so, you know, Spartan is running towards him in the distance, and then Phoenix sees it and just kind of runs off, which Nigel makes it out like, oh, he was going to kill me, and you saved my life, so I'm going to reward you by taking you and your partner, Huxley, to a very nice restaurant called Taco Bell. Which Spartan is...
Yeah. Big joke in the movie.
Yeah, and Spartan's like, what? Oh, thanks, I guess, thinking Taco Bell is, you know, the Taco Bell of today or even the 90s. But he kind of feels off about Nigel because...
And when I was a kid, yeah, like, as I mentioned, when I was a kid, I didn't really get this. I was like, yeah, it must be a fast food place of some sort. But I'm sure I've seen it in other movies, heard about it in other movies. But that was my only reference point to it. So I didn't even... And, like... I didn't even really know it was like until he says the line about burritos in the movie. I didn't know it's like a Mexican place. I could have been anything. Apparently, there is a European edit of this movie where they made it Pizza Hut, but that is, I've never seen that version of the movie. So I was kind of confused by this, but kind of got the joke, sort of.
I wonder if that was like sponsorship overseas or...
I don't know. Apparently it was just because, like, you know, Pizza Hut was like a known franchise in European countries, whereas Taco Bell is, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how many. It's not really a known franchise, like, either here in the UK or in continental Europe, yeah, either.
And so what we learn, though, about this is that there was the franchise wars where now every restaurant is a Taco Bell. So there's no such thing as other food, I guess.
Which I want to see that Netflix docuseries.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The franchise wars. I mean,
that's like the next Tiger King, you know? I want to see this.
I definitely watch a 10-part documentary series on that. It's interesting to me because, like, I don't know, maybe they just weren't interested or whatever, but, like, you would assume because they genuinely are worldwide and you can find them anywhere in the world that, like, McDonald's would be the go-to. Because, like, they are, like, a known franchise, like, worldwide, unlike Taco Bell, which mainly exists in North America and nowhere else.
Yeah.
I would assume that McDonald's wanted way more.
Yeah.
Way more in advertising, and Taco Bell.
Yeah, right, okay.
We'll pay you much less. Put our stuff in your movie, please.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, it's probably true. It's probably true.
And it probably sells the joke better, too, having it be something like Taco, especially during the 90s when it was... not so big. It was like, oh, you're mean this, you know, kind of area where you get, you know, $1 burritos or whatever it may be. They're, yeah, who knows?
Who knows?
But,
who knows?
So, yeah. They're driving and they're, at this point, he still doesn't know how to drive these new cars, which will pop up later. And,
oh, I loved how, like, his first reaction was just like, I'll drive because. Yeah. Like, that's how we treat female. Like, because I was like, of course this guy doesn't trust female drivers. Because that's exactly who he is.
Yeah. And then he sits in it and he instantly just goes, nope, you drove.
I do not understand this technology. Yeah.
And so they're basically, again, they're giving a little more exposition about the world building, about, like, the franchise wars and things like that.
And the Schwarzenegger presidential library.
Yes, because he was so popular that he became the 61st Amendment made him the president. And obviously that's another kind of ongoing joke in Stallone movies of him making comments about Schwarzenegger or knocking him or trying to
make some jest. It also speaks to this movie's excellent predictive powers, because 10 years after this, he would become governor of California.
Yeah.
There was some minor talk of an Arnold Amendment. It didn't get very far. I think it was just a few of Arnold's closest allies kind of pushing that, but there was some minor talk,
which is it's
we got another TV.
Yeah, I know. Like, we'll not dive too far into that.
Yeah, we'll avoid the politics because.
Yeah, I mean, we have been openly shitting on the alt-right and its relationship to this movie. But yes, we will avoid the politics. And,
and so they get there, and yes, Taco Bell is basically like a high-end fancy restaurant. All of the stuff is on. It's like what he gets six basically tortilla chips with, like, you know, I don't know,
some sort of colored paste. It's supposed to be kind of nouvelle cuisine style, like, you know, like a French chef kind of thing. But like, it just kind of looks weird. But yeah.
But they don't even have salt because it's bad for you. And everybody.
Therefore illegal.
Yeah. And all of the people at the table, like Associate Bob and I guess his date or some, I don't know. They're filmed together. So I'm.
His cover.
Yeah. They're.
Again, we should probably mention, and again, this is one of those things that thankfully we get less of, but Associate Bob is an effeminate man. And the movie just treats this naturally, as all action movies of this time did, as suspicious.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And
wrong.
He's also, you would know him probably better from as Ortho from Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
I mean, he has had a long career. I know he passed away in 2010 or something.
2010, yeah. Yep. So sadly, he wasn't that old. But yeah.
But so they're basically, to his face, they're calling him a brute, and they're not really subtle about how much disdain they have for him, being that it's supposed to be this polite society.
Yeah, throughout the movie, he's kind of been called a Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon man, you know, like all this kind of chat.
But he is also very brash about basically thinking that this world is kind of a crappy world, and that he'd rather be back in the freezer, and that even the cryogenic, I guess, process, he was supposed to be in like a sleep state, but he confirms that he wasn't asleep. It was basically like a frozen or awake and frozen type of thing or something.
Which, another thing of this script.
Yeah.
All of this pain from this character of, hey, I was frozen, but I was awake, so I saw my wife visit me and talk to me, but I couldn't talk back. It wouldn't have been really nice to have seen kind of this pain with not being able to speak to your wife. I think would have established this character a little bit more.
Yeah.
We start the turmoil and the pain that he's suffering from. I miss my wife, who we never see.
Which is just negated a couple scenes from now. We'll get to that.
But I get, like, as I mentioned off air before the podcast started, I think that Stallone is the only person who doesn't know the movie he's in, because the rest of the people in the movie realize this is an over-the-top comic book satire on comedy on action movies, and he thinks he's in like a kind of serious sci-fi action, so he keeps giving these kind of emotional grace notes that don't fit within the universe of the movie. Like, yeah.
But and everyone else around the table is like, Stallone, come on. We want this to be on the head. Shut up.
Have some fun with it. Come on.
You just have fun with it. Like, this is a Daft movie you're in. It's got a very similar tone to something like Last Action Hero, where everything's kind of over the top and overdone and deliberately kind of overcooked, but he's just doing it like, and he, like, half his dialogue, he kind of growls as if, you know, this is deadly, you know, the manhunt to get Neil Simon Phoenix is deadly, deadly serious, and everybody else is just like, we don't know what movie you're in.
We even get a bit.
We'll regret this, both seconds of it.
Yeah,
just your life, both seconds of it.
Yeah, we even get a point where, like, it shows how they handle things. If he wants to track down Simon and all that, and they say, well, let's just wait till he kills somebody else and then we'll know where he's at. Like, I mean, that's the type of movie, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But while we're waiting,
yes,
you see all these metal pop-up telescope things through the city. And now we finally get a little glimpse of what these scrap people are, and they bombard a Taco Bell catering van out front.
Yeah. So
all these people stealing all of the gourmet Taco Bell food for themselves. And Spartan, you know, takes out a couple of them because he sees crime. But then after, when everyone escapes, the leader, played by Dennis Leary, Mr. Friendly or whatever, he finds out that, hey, they're coming in for food. So they're not really criminals. And then he feels bad about beating up
all these innocent people.
All they wanted was food.
Yeah. And he tells that he's pretty blunt about it to Nigel, of telling them, you know, he doesn't believe that's wrong. You know, and throughout this whole thing, he's made it very clear there's no subtlety about his suspicions for Nigel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being the villain.
Yeah, no, there's no subtlety. And the scraps, as we see them, are basically kind of Road Warrior ripoffs, like many movies set in kind of, this is a kind of dystopia, I suppose, but you know, in these kind of like other post-apocalyptic films and stuff like that, you know, like they all just look like they're from the Road Warrior, and the scraps also look like they're from the Road Warrior. Also in this scene, I've written down, like, because I do very much enjoy all of Sandra Bullock's spoonerisms.
Yes.
So like when she's like, ah, I guess there's a new shepherd in town. And it's like, what are you talking about? Sheriff. It's supposed to be sheriff.
Yeah.
And those also, are great.
Yeah. She also does the, you really licked his ass or something like that.
You really licked his ass. And it's like, no, it's supposed to be kicked his ass.
Yeah.
He's great here, though. He's just a delight on screen.
Yeah.
Oh, as much as we talked about Wesley Snipes being the best thing in the movie, Sandra Bullock is very much the second best thing in the movie. Her character is genuine, and just her constant perky enthusiasm for all that's going on, all the action and violence that's going on, and everything. And like I say, yes, her running kind of gags of all these kind of weird spinnerisms, she is a delight throughout the movie. Yeah. And her performance is great. I love Sandra Bullock in this movie.
And before,
there is the only police character here with their head on their shoulders.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. She's the only one who knows what she is doing.
Rob Schneider's there being Rob Schneider.
Yeah.
He's the only one.
Well, and we talked before the recording started about how we would have loved to, you almost feel like the better version of this movie sadly wouldn't have Stallone. It would have been Bullock, like, learning the new way or learning the old ways to capture, you know, Phoenix. Or yeah. So Huxley trying to capture Phoenix.
And this would have been the Sandra Bullock movie instead of a Stallone movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think could have been fun. Yeah, and I think, like, she just learned all the, you know, you could have even included Stallone in a way of, like, you know, you could have had, like, her watching, like, a Rambo movie, Lethal Weapon movies, you know, the Jackie Chan movies, and, like, it's just, she gets all her tactics from that, and then it's just, like, a series of, like, action movie references of her doing kind of different set pieces from different action movies, and then going up against this kind of cartoony villain in Snipes and stuff. I could have dug that.
Yeah,
I still love this movie, but I think it could have been great too.
Right, but instead, Stallone wanted to have a sex scene with her.
Yeah, which we're getting to. Yeah,
yes. So this is kind of awkward. So Stallone is
so despite his love for his wife.
Yeah, despite the trauma that he's still like, because literally, you know, like two scenes before, he's talking about his wife pounding on the ice of his cryogenic chamber, you know, in tears, and how much this kind of ripped his heart, and now, and 2 seconds later, Huxley makes a sexual pass at him, and he's like, "Yeah, all right, let's go."
Well, it's even earlier that day he woke up and realized that she died. So it's like not even 24 hours since all of this happened.
Oh And this is the part where I'm dead set on, like, Huxley was supposed to be either a daughter or a granddaughter or something.
Well, the thing is, right, wanted... so in real life, at the time, Stallone is about 18 years older than Sandra Bullock. So at the time, Sandra Bullock would have been about 29, and, Stallone would have been about 47. And she's a young-looking 29, so it does look odd. It's like, eh.
But the way that they do it is it's all virtual. It's all through brainwaves and stuff, because the exchange of fluids is illegal, again, unless you have a license. And then Stallone has an amazing moment
where
Sandra Bullock is like, what would you call it? Or what would you call having sex? And he goes, well, I mean, boning, the wild mamba, the hunka hunka.
Like, this is, but this scene kills me, right? This scene absolutely kills me, because I do not think anybody in human history, apart from Stallone in this scene, has called sex the hunka chunka.
Yeah.
Never in my mind, but I could have listened to another hour of just riffing off different names for sex. And that would have been the movie for me. I wouldn't have cared about anything else.
Well, and it's so amazing, because so when he's wearing that virtual reality helmet or whatever, you're seeing the flashes in his head of, I guess, him virtually having sex with her, and then it would cut to his face where he's just sitting there still and he's, you know, having an orgasm, and it's just hysterical.
That was real fun.
Yeah, just that whole scene. In a couple movies or a while that I just forget. I know there's the sex scene, you know, having seen it a bunch of times, but I just forgot how outrageous the whole thing is, I guess.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I mean, like even before, you know, what you were talking about, Caleb, which is amazing. I could have done with just keep giving them different euphemisms. Just keep it going. 10 minutes of that. Yeah, that would have been great. But the faces he pulls when he's got that VR headset on and he's trying to simulate, like, sexual excitement, and he just looks kind of vaguely constipated.
What is this?
And I don't know why then he, like, because it has him base almost climaxing and then he rips it off, but he seems to be, you know, enjoying it up until that point. Like, I don't know, it just then ends weird. Like, yeah, again, it's outrageous and then it's awkward too. It's like,
yeah,
but then through all of this exchange, Huxley is like, nope, get out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's because at this point, the Spartan then tries to force himself on her, because, like, kissing is, like, illegal now, you know, like, all sexual contact
illegal.
So he tries to force himself on her, and then she's like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't happen, Spartan.
Yeah. Right. Again, yes, absolutely. It is.
And so she lists, so it was like the AIDS epidemic, and then she goes through, so after AIDS, there was like three or four other
sexually transmitted
kind of diseases or virus. Yeah. And so then he leaves and goes to his apartment, and that's where I know, Scott, you brought up about Joe Silver, the producer.
Yes.
Who's always
so, like, he gets like a wrong call for, like, from somebody who's obviously about to have some phone sex, and it's just this naked girl is like, oh, I'm sorry, I must have got the wrong number. And I just, like, kind of pictured being like Joel Silver, you know, smoking a big cigar, being like, there's not quite enough tits in this movie, let's get some more tits in the movie.
Yeah, because nothing happens. It just, nope, sorry. Yeah. And then she's gone, and we never. Oh, okay.
See,
that was a thing.
And see, that's the point where it's like, so you cut out the plot to explain the daughter, but you have this scene in it, which has no purpose. Like, you could literally cut that whole scene out. And,
oh yeah, when he's going around the apartment, you're like, yeah, that whole scene is like he goes around the apartment. We get a call back to the three seashells. He trips over some stuff and remembers that all the lights are voice activated. He like the only part of the scene that we actually, well, you don't even need this, the scene where he works out that like Raymond Cocteau's the bad guy. That could have been placed somewhere else. We don't need to have a random scene of him sitting knitting and working out that Raymond Cocteau's the bad guy.
Yeah. I feel like the knitting gag, they should have either brought it in early. I don't know, because it doesn't play as funny as I think they wanted it to be.
Oh, no. Like, I don't think it plays as funny as it. Like you say, I think they should have brought it in earlier. And also, it does just feel like one of those gags of being like, yeah, okay, so he can knit now. That's fine. I suppose that's a skill to have. I suppose it's like we're supposed to be like, oh, that's hilarious because knitting should be only done by women. Like, but it's just like, yeah, okay,
cool. And it's another instance because the next day he knits the sweater for Leslie, and then again,
yeah. He is not just a seamstress; he is an expert seamstress to knit a full sweater in just a night. Part of a night, because he spent part of the night with amazing.
But it's his comedic delivery, or at least his concept of comedic delivery of, hey, I'm going to start yelling and raise my voice, and that makes it funnier. I can knit and sew and do all this. What's going on?
What, I'm a seamstress now? Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things where if you give Stallone a quippy action movie one-liner, he can deliver the comedy of that,
right?
But he can't deliver the like straightforward comedy. Like, it's the only sort of comedy that he can deliver, of like, you know, where he's doing the quippy one-liners of like, you know, back when the hand-to-hand fight was happening, where he electrocuted Snipes before he electrocuted Snipes, you know, where it's like he throws a TV at him and he's like, ah, you're on TV now, ha ha ha. You know, like, he can do that, and that's the only type of comedy he can do.
So that would have, I think, like we were talking about with this knitting one, would have worked, because we talked about putting it earlier, and it could have even went with the concept we were saying with Bullock, if she was just the main character, of that he comes out of the cryogenic, or his thawed out, but now he's not like the super cop anymore. And so they're almost retrained, you know, or something, so that now he's just, his only skill set is a seamstress, or whatever they call it, you know.
Right, so it's not violent anymore or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he has to kind of relearn his old ways. Oh, that could have been an interesting take, yeah.
I mean, that fits, I guess, with what the joke and what the whole idea of these, like, reprogramming things are. I don't know.
Yeah, but this element does, like, of the many elements of this movie that are actually glorious, this element doesn't work so much.
And so he gets the video. So I guess the only thing from those scenes is he gets the video footage that shows that they were talking beforehand, and he wants to go confront
Cocteau.
Yeah. That he decides he's going off of a police hunch, which apparently police officers no longer have. And he's going to talk to him, but he said he'll be subtle. And basically he just comes in, passes by Associate Bob, is able to find him, despite him being originally on screen, but they just find him, and he tells him straight out that he thinks he would be, or that he's working with him for some reason. And then because somebody like Phoenix, he gave him 10 seconds, and that's 9.5 seconds longer than he would have given anybody else. So, and yeah, he points the gun at him, and he shoots the screens, and that's
just before that Simon got back with Nigel Hawthorne and was like, I need more people to help me.
Yes.
And then they unfreeze Jesse the Body Ventura.
I wish there was more Jesse the Body Ventura in this movie.
Which I heard he was, that was one of the, some of the cuts, is he was supposed to be a bigger presence in the...
Yeah, I can imagine that, you know, because it does feel kind of, because he feels like he's going to be like Phoenix's number two, and it does feel like he... It feels like there should have been more of him, like, and it makes sense that, like, some of his stuff was cut, because it feels like the movie treats him as a more important character than actually the amount of time he's on screen suggests he is.
Yeah, that's the big thing. He says he has a list of people he wants thought out to take him down and do this job and also kill Friendly, but none of those guys from New York, because they're all, which I didn't know, is that an inside joke type of thing? Or because I know Snipes did a lot of films that took place in New York, or I didn't know if it was just within the script itself. I didn't know if it was a call to something else.
I'm not sure I'm not sure what, if that's like a specific reference or just like something the script's thrown out.
Okay.
But then after that is when they go to investigate the underground.
Yes.
Yes.
And again, I feel like this is one of these scenes where, like, again, everybody else knows the movie they're in but Stallone, because like as they go off marching to the you know, to go to the sewer, and you know, the kind of, there before they get to the kind of manhole cover and go down into the sewer, like Stallone's just like growling orders and stuff like that, and then everybody else is kind of being comical around him, like Benjamin Bratt's like enhance your cam, and then like Sandra Bullock's doing her stuff and that as well, and it just feels, again, there's that kind of like slight disconnect from him to the rest of the cast. And yeah, also we get another great spinnerism as like Sandra Bullock is like, yeah, let's go and blow him.
Yes.
And Stallone's like, it's blow him away. Blow him away is the phrase.
And so, I mean, what's nice too is that what we learn about this sewer is that it doesn't smell like, because we keep getting this mentality, even with Phoenix when he's going in there, he says it reminds him of, what is it, something grits.
Biscuits and gravy. Yeah, it reminds him of biscuits and gravy. Yes, again, yes, like it's not really a reference I get. I don't really want to know
what Well, that's what I didn't know, because so much of the character is, because we talked about, like, who else could have been written for it? And it's not, I don't know, it feels like one of those kind of racially insensitive comments.
Because yes, it does, I suppose. Yeah, it does.
But then...
I wonder if that line was, like, because I now can't remember if this was only mentioned off air, but, like, so, originally, it was pitched to Seagal and Van Damme, and Van Damme was going to be the villain, but then Van Damme didn't want to play a villain, so like that all fell through and it became Stallone and Snipes. But I maybe that was only inserted once Snipes was on board.
Yeah, that's what I was curious, because it feels, I don't know, listening to it, it just felt weird. But so you think, oh, it's going to have the sewer smell, but no, it's the smell of, like, you know, seasoning and, you know, grilling and
home cooking,
and yeah,
stuff from the time before,
yeah,
before times.
And they realize that even though there are these cops in this area, that everybody's very nice and docile. And then he needs to take a little pit stop to grab himself a burger and a beer. But it's just, yeah.
And again, like when you think about the stuff the movie cuts, as much as it seems kind of fun, where he has, like, he enjoys his rat burger, and there's this big joke of, like, guys, you know, like, oh, he's not had the burger in all these years. It turns out it's made of rat and stuff like that. Again, it's like one of those scenes that's like, yeah, it doesn't really need to be there. And when you think about all the kind of subplots and kind of things that were cut, it's like, but that survived? That's interesting choices you've made.
Yeah. It's like they kept some of the stuff to make it more, to have it fall more in line with a comedy.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Than having it more of an action movie. I don't know.
I think the scene works. I think it's like a fun scene. Yeah.
But then they meet Friendly, who in Dennis Leary fashion is basically, or early fashion, is basically giving Dennis Leary stand-up monologue at one point. That's like, it's Dennis Leary playing stand-up Dennis Leary.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's definitely, yeah, he just gives a kind of stand-up, like, as much, I actually do like some of Dennis Leary's early stand-up, but as has been a noted criticism of his early stand-up, I did put in my notes, Leary gives sub-Hixian monologue.
Yeah.
which, if you are not aware of stand-up comedian Bill Hicks, well, make yourself aware of him. And also, it was noted in the early part of Dennis Leary's stand-up career how similar some of his material, or a lot of his material, was to Mr. Bill Hicks.
Yeah, and it's basically him saying, you know, I don't want to live in that world. And it's him, he would go fast, and it'd be like almost like a rant of saying, I want to eat meat at any point. I want to be able to cover myself in jelly and naked. Read
Playboy.
Yeah.
Run down the street naked and in lime jello reading Playboy or something. Something like that. Yeah, it's kind of like, the monologue he gives is kind of like his asshole song, which is an entertaining song.
basically it. So you're seeing almost the, and it'll come up at the end, the tie-in at the end, the two complete opposites of the spectrum, I guess, of like total anarchy versus, you know, the
full peaceful law and order, I guess.
Yeah.
And again, I suppose it makes it sort of prescient because, again, it seems to represent like the kind of two furthest poles of Twitter, you know?
Yeah.
and we'll get to the amazing resolution that we
yes, the call for peace at the end of this movie is it's excellent. It's inspiring, heartwarming, mind opening. It's so good. Yeah. But that's the end of the movie, Caleb. We still got plot to do.
I know.
He just wants to move this along.
He's just fast forward in there.
So, but then, you know, Phoenix and his crew of criminals have found them and decide, and they're like, whoa, two for one deal. They were both here. And they decide to start opening fire. And what is it? So Benjamin Bratt, Garcia is what, he's knocked on the head, so they have to leave him behind. But Huxley and Spartan are able to take a little special vehicle, and it's a, you know, obviously it's a muscle car and a classic one in 1970. I can't remember, but it's, you know, it's basically like a Detroit muscle.
Something or other. Is it some sort of Corvette or something? Okay.
Yeah, and they go on to a high speed chase where Phoenix has their cop car. And so they're going down the streets in this muscle car and crashing through things and living up to his name as the demolition man. Even to, for some reason, to get out of the sewer, they take an elevator which crashes through a building, and then they drive out of the building. So, you know,
it's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Does a single person die in the shootout?
I don't know.
Because I remember them shooting, and I remember sparks flying and everyone taking cover, but I don't remember people falling down as if they were shot.
Yeah, I don't know. I think like a lot of the violence in this movie is like the violence in like the A-Team or whatever, you know, where like a lot of people get shot and like it seems like a lot of people die, but like it doesn't have any kind of, because there's no kind of blood squirts or there's no kind of impact. It doesn't feel like anything has happened. You see what I mean?
It doesn't have the weight of actual people dying.
I don't know. It was just, I hear gunshots, take cover, but nothing.
Yeah.
No bullets
We got a fun close up of Jesse the Body Ventura shooting a bunch of people and looking like he's having a fun time.
Yeah. So they go on the chase, and then he jumps when she's driving. He jumps into that car. He's able to pull him out, but unfortunately, the car crashes into the water. So Phoenix is able to escape and his crew. And another joke about knitting comes up again, where the whole car is caked in this kind of safety foam. And
yeah, where it's basically the ripped. Car turns into a meringue.
Yeah.
Looks cool.
Yeah. It does.
And he gets out and he's like, well, don't worry, I'll be able to fix it tonight. It's like, oh, did I just say that? So, obviously it's another callback to that he's a amazing seamstress now.
Yes. And again, it's shown that when Stallone is asked to do straightforward comedy, it just doesn't work for some reason. He just can't do it.
Yeah.
I've just realized, just talking about Jesse the Body Ventura, they really missed a trick. They should have gone full wrestling, and they should have had when it came to the final battle between Snipes and Stallone, they should have had Jesse commentating.
You should have brought in Monsoon. Look at these two titans, Gorilla. Oh, man. You're right.
Phoenix and him with a real Pearl Harbor job right there.
He didn't cheat. He was playing. He tripped. That's all it was.
The Spartan makes me sick. Other than Craig, you're not getting any of this, but Caleb and I are having a whale of a time. But anyway, yeah. Craig, you were catching up with the plot. Let's get back to the plot. Yeah. We've already run out of tangent credits an hour ago, so we're really fucking up here. Yeah.
Well, so now we get, this is where we get back to Cocteau. Yep, Cocteau, who, obviously Phoenix wants to just move on and not be his lackey anymore, but he can't kill him. So he just has, again, a character that's Ventura, who's supposed to be, seems like a bigger character. He just has his right-hand man shoot him.
Yep. And
that's it.
Although, yeah. I mean, this scene is properly funny as well.
Yeah.
Because, Cocteau is giving this big villain speech of how he can even more kind of mold his perfect society, and throughout this whole speech Snipes is trying to work out how he can kill him himself, and keeps pointing the gun at him at different angles and being like, God, it's so funny.
Yeah,
you gotta mention the best lines of the speech though, because Nigel Hawthorne, he says, the people are finally intimidated by you, and Simon Phoenix says, what can I say, people are always intimidated by me. And then the best line of the entire movie, Hawthorne says, yes, but this time they're really intimidated. I put down here writing.
Caleb, though, are you really saying that's an even better line than what, booning one member of the Honka Chunka?
You know what? Yes, this is the best line.
Okay.
They're intimidated. No. They're really intimidated. Craig, you mentioned the thesaurus earlier on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really intimidating.
Yeah.
I like to think in the script that really was just all caps.
Yeah. And no, it's great all around. And so what is it? He's going to kill Associate Bob too, but Associate Bob being that, he clings to whoever's in charge, I guess, in that way. He says, well, I can help you. I have better ideas. And that they're going to basically unleash the army of frozen prisoners.
Yep.
Because the plot.
Yep. Yep. Because the plot.
It seems like if he was, no longer attached to that guy anymore, he would be now fine just doing whatever. But,
apparently Phoenix has this urge to lead an army of criminals.
Yeah,
I guess
that is his deal that has been well established throughout the film.
Yeah.
It's always been his plan, not just randomly murdering people for his own amusement. Anyway, Spartan and Huxley come onto the scene.
and they're going to stop it all.
Yeah, this is the we're finally at the climax of the movie. It just kind of moves.
Yeah, it moves real quick from there on.
And Huxley plays a huge role that she knows how to, you know, fight really well. So obvious because of Jackie Chan movies. So obviously she will play a bigger part in the end.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this action sequence, they take on various of the henchmen of the cryocons, as they're referred to in the credits. And Huxley beats one of them up with her martial arts skills, as we've talked about, learned from Jackie Chan movies, and then saves Spartan's life by shooting one of the guys who was creeping up behind him. And so obviously, yeah, they're going to tackle Phoenix together, or what actually happens, Caleb?
Oh, she gets knocked out from one of the nightsticks or whatever it's called. I forget what it's called.
Yeah, the batten thing. Yeah,
the batten. Yeah, and then she's just put aside out of harm's reach because you know what? This movie is Stallone versus Snipes, and it needs to come down to Stallone versus Snipes.
So yeah, they need their mania moment.
This is the mega powers colliding, and they go to the lab, the cryogenic freezing area where everything is starting to happen, and they start having their good old shootout.
Which
associate Bob leaves him because they're shooting each other. I forget what the exact line is, but he's just like, eh, bye.
Well, I like how just before we get like the final battle as well, like in last week's film Cliffhanger, there was a scene where we knew that Stallone meant business because he turned his cap backwards. In this movie, we know Stallone means business because he gets his beret back.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then they're unthawing prisoners, and one of them is Jeffrey Dahmer. He's like, oh, I need that guy.
Like, I think this is one of my favorite lines in the movie, just with the relish that Snipe says it, of he just goes, Jeffrey Dahmer? I love that guy.
Yeah. As if we didn't know he was evil enough.
Even at this point in the movie, we are still establishing how evil Simon Phoenix is.
So they start fighting. Spartan is grabbed by the claw thing that's supposed to grab the chunks of ice, and he's going to be dropped into, isn't he?
He's going to be dropped back into.
He's going to have target practice.
Yes.
Shooting at the claw and keeps him missing. So I guess practice makes perfect. I guess he's gonna keep trying to shoot him, but he uses the I don't know what's in the hydraulics of the claw. He freezes it and then breaks out.
Yeah, it seems like I don't know. Like he breaks one of the kind of pipes. And like it seems like, I don't know, it's like liquid nitrogen or something, and then he kind of sprays that on the claw, which freezes the claw, which makes it malleable enough to kind of smash.
And then that foreshadowing starts to come in to the first battle of the movie.
This is hand-to-hand combat round three.
Yeah, and they're in, so there's the liquid everywhere, which, is it water or at first, or is it just the... I don't know.
A type of goo or something that they put in.
Some sort of weird goo that becomes frozen on with the little thing from the test tube thing. Like, I don't know. It's a sci-fi action movie. It's not well explained.
Yeah.
It's the frozen glow bead or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big bright glow beads. Lights up the goop and it becomes frozen. Okay? Just go with it, Craig.
Yeah. And Phoenix, Snipes is just selling the fight, I guess. You know, he's making the great faces and the noise. It's just conk. And then when it looks like he's finally going to get Spartan and hit him, Spartan is able to grab one of the freezy sticks, I guess we could call it.
We'll call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always call it that.
It smashes it into the goo. glow goo, and that makes everything freeze, in which he has to jump out of the way, but it freezes Phoenix. And then he's spinning around and he kicks Phoenix's head off again in connection to the first fight where Phoenix talks about losing his head.
Yeah. And again, Stallone knows how to deliver these lines. So like he gives the quip, heads up. And like, you know, I laughed at that. And he knows how to deliver comedy like that just in no other way. I like, yeah, still baffles me. But anyway, it is what it is.
So now we're kind of reaching the end where he comes out. The chief has to give kind of like a kind of apology to him. We get dramatic
running away from an explosion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We can't not talk about it. We can't not mention that. Or we have to mention that anytime it happens in any action film, because it's always good, dramatic slow-mo running away from an explosion.
Yes. And as the building is kind of blowing up with all of the frozen prisoners, makes you wonder, well, maybe some of those frozen prisoners weren't there. I don't know. They're all dead. Just assume that. All the prisoners. I mean,
shouldn't we freeze him again since he killed all of these people in this building?
The many, many more people in this
building. Yeah. Oh, earlier during the car chase, we forgot to mention that that it turns out all of the hostages from the very beginning were dead before the explosion, and that Phoenix was just framed Spartan. Oh, so
we do?
Yes, that was the kind of like big reveal of like, oh, he was innocent all along. They were already, yeah, and that's why his thermal scan only scanned like 8 people, because like it, you know,
they were already dead.
They were already dead.
That completely missed me.
Yeah, it's
because like you know, we couldn't have like our hero be like an anti-hero. He has to be a hero.
So yeah, so there was that, and yeah, so he gets out of the explosion, and luckily Huxley woke up from her being knocked out, so that she was out of the building, and then with they're greeted by basically everybody left in the movie that are the good guys. And then now what, Garcia is joined.
He's one of the scraps for some reason, that it's just like, oh, okay, he got knocked out once and now his whole life has changed. Again, just got to roll with it, I suppose.
Yeah.
The film is just trying to wrap up as quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. It's just kind of like, yeah, we're really, this is the end of proceedings. Like, don't pay attention to anything. Just like, good guys won.
Yeah. And so they're going to do, or there's the two opposite sides, and Friendly wants to just really, you know, paint the town red, I guess, with anarchy. And this is kind of the glorious moment that we've been discussing throughout, of it trying to say we should all just get along and find a middle ground.
So, Caleb, can you, you know, you wanted to talk about this. Yes. This amazing clarion call for peace and harmony amongst all people across all political spectrums.
Well, coming from the man who ended communism in the end after he defeated Drago, it could only come from the mouth of Stallone by saying to societies that, well, I guess you'll figure it out. Yeah. You're just going to have to find some middle ground here.
And like you say, I think the film is just so concerned with wrapping up. It's just like, we don't care anymore. It's like, it's the way he says it of like, well, you guys, you gotta get a whole lot cleaner, and you guys, you gotta dirty yourself up a bit, and then, you know, like, maybe something in the middle work. I don't know. Well, you'll figure it out.
Come over here, Bullock, so I can kiss you.
Yeah.
Well, this is Deus Ex Machina. Let's wrap this up as quickly as possible. We're well over an hour and a half time. We're done here.
Yeah. And so,
and then we end on a great, a sweeping non-consensual kiss, and you know, it's supposed to be real sweet and romantic, and then one last three seashell callback.
Oh yeah. What is the deal with the seashell? But she also says, so is that what all like touching or makes some comment about like, is that what all fluid
fluid exchanges are like? Yeah.
And he's like,
no, it's better.
Yeah. And then we get original Demolition Man song in the credits.
Yes, the Demolition Man theme sung by Sting, yeah. And it rocks.
Yeah.
I'm loving its early 90s vibes. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Apparently, this was there was like an earlier version of this song. Apparently, the song was actually originally on a Grace Jones album, and this is like a kind of heavied up version of the original song. Like, Sting wrote the original song as well, but apparently there was an earlier version on a Grace Jones record called Nightclubbin'.
Interesting.
And that's it. We've got there. We were in much less of a hurry to wrap up than the movie was.
Yeah.
So that was our thoughts on Demolition Man. If you've got thoughts of your own that maybe contradict our thoughts or agree with our thoughts, please do get in touch with us. Please do rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, basically wherever you get your podcasts from. It just leaves me to thank my regular co-host, Craig Jaheim, who will be coming back next week for The Specialist.
Yep, that's always a pleasure.
And thank you very much, Caleb, for coming on as our very special guest for the day. Before we go on out, do you want to give your YouTube channel a quick plug?
Yeah, sure. If anyone is listening to this and want to, and we're not annoyed by me at all, you can check me out on YouTube under Caleb Watches Movies, where I just randomly select any movie that I own or ones that are recommended to me and watch them all at random and give my thoughts. And just a fun thing that I started a couple of years ago, and it's led me to talking with you two today. So it's, again, I appreciate any subscription you would provide for me.
And it has a really kind of down to earth approach too, where you look at it as like just a regular viewer as well.
I really know nothing. It's just the average guy just watching a movie saying, okay, like I like this and I like that. So that's my take on it. So, but I think both of you, Scott and Craig, for inviting me on here. Hopefully you'll be back again for other films. Again, the whole 90s action genre I was sheltered on. But I've been opening the door more, especially with films like this. So thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. So we definitely recommend to all our listeners to go and check out Caleb's channel. And we will definitely have you back on, Caleb. But that really is all for this time. Please be sure to join us again next week for The Specialist. But until then, see ya.